Not surprisingly, there is a raging debate in policymaking circles, in the pages of academic journals, and in the international press about how we are going to confront the challenges of economic development. In particular, how to resolve the tensions between the pressures on the environment and scarce resources associated with economic growth, and the unsatisfied needs of the millions of poor. One side argues that the planet is not salvageable as long as international capitalism prevails, with its focus on growth and profits at all costs and predatory resource capture. If we're truly concerned about helping the poor rather than the rich, we need a new development model. Susan George, for instance, advocates what she calls ecological Keynesianism, drawing parallels with the Allied response to fascism during the Second World War and the swift transformation of the economy to a war footing, a massive shift of resources and priorities by governments to deal with the upcoming environmental catastrophes is what is needed. A sort of third way, she argues, between red-in-tooth-and-claw capitalism and a worldwide uprising as unlikely as it is utopian. Too often, in my view, the debates about the enormous limitations of the present economic system take place against complete ignorance of the awful historical record of the alternatives tried during the past century. John Gray, an emeritus professor of economics at the London School of Economics, responding to the question if the free market corrodes moral character, writes, "The moral hazards of free markets do not mean that other economic systems are any better. Centrally planned systems have corroded character far more damagingly and with fewer benefits in terms of efficiency and productivity. People with the most highly developed survival skills and the fewest moral scruples did best." Equally insightful are the comments by the French philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy. I quote, "First, if the market corrupts, the various negations of the market corrupt absolutely. Look at fascism, and look at that other hatred of the market that preceded and followed it, communism. I doubt that anybody would posit communism as the fulfillment of character and soul for its victims or agents. Second, it is necessary to choose," he argues. "If these corruptions must be ranked, it is patently obvious that the communist or the fascist corruption through the negation of the market is significantly deeper, deadlier, and more irreparable than the first." It is imperative, in my view, that we refrain from fruitless debates about the relative merits of particular economic systems and from succumbing to the temptation of seeing contemporary problems, poverty, income disparities, climate change, as being purely manifestations of systemic failure. The market is simply one mechanism within a larger framework of institutions and values, and the reality is considerably more complex. Countries which have been successful in boosting income per capita, in broadening the range of available opportunities for their respective populations and in reducing the incidence of poverty out of those where successive governments have taken a pragmatic approach to policy formulation and implementation, taking the best of an otherwise rich menu of options and doing so in a context fairly free of useless, tired debates about whether the approach being followed was faithful or not to a particular ideology, capitalist, Marxist, or otherwise. One can characterize as unjust the fact that South Korean citizens today have an income per capita that is 15 times higher than their brothers and sisters in Ghana. But one cannot neglect the equally sobering fact that as recently as 1960, Ghana was actually ahead of South Korea in this key indicator. To attribute these differences to injustice or to try to explain them in light of some inherent flaw in the capitalist system is misleading and not particularly helpful. It is misleading because it fails to explain why some economies, such as South Korea, Singapore, New Zealand, Ireland, Taiwan, Malaysia, all the Nordics, the list is much longer, have done so well, capitalism notwithstanding, And it is unhelpful because it neglects the role of good governance and policies in guiding constructive processes of change. South Korea is today a developed country, and Ghana and most of sub-Saharan Africa countries are not. The human beings living in these countries are all God's creatures. But the key challenge of development is identifying the factors, the policies and institutions that have determined their different development paths. In South Korea, these led to high levels of per capita income, highly educated populations with labor forces that are skilled and able to operate on the frontiers of technology, where economic activity takes place in a context of relative openness and transparency, with clear and predictable rules, where corruption is relatively rare and the government is made periodically legitimate through some form of vote, and so on. In the case of Ghana, they led to all the ills and tragedies which are in full evidence when one travels around the developing world. It is useless to pretend that there is no difference. It is important to distinguish between the individuals and the policies or systems they live under, which range from the enlightened to the deplorable, and which go a long way to explaining why some countries are rich and prosperous and others are poor and lacking in opportunity. From this perspective, poverty and underdevelopment have little to do with culture and more with what happens when economies malfunction, when the software that drives them has broken down or is no longer relevant for the time and the place. The problems of poverty, lack of opportunity, and concern for the environment have little to do with the presence or absence of capitalism, and much more to do with weak institutions and systems of incentives which often misdirect resources or create huge wasteful distortions. What is needed are honest and thoughtful leaders who will have credibility with the public and who will build institutions, improve the regulatory framework, manage scarce resources more effectively, and so on. The example of the Nordic countries is useful by way of illustration. The primary mechanism of distribution in most modern societies is the government budget and the tax policy that underlies it. The Nordic countries have developed an economic model based on the provision of an extensive safety net, which involves relatively high levels of taxation, and simultaneously they have managed to remain among the most competitive economies in the world. This disproves the fallacy that less government is always better because high taxes will discourage private initiative. What matters surely is how the taxes collected are used. If they are often stolen or otherwise misused, then yes, high taxes will kill the private sector that in turn will find ways not to pay them. But if, as in the Nordics, the tax revenue goes to education, to improving the country's infrastructure, to enhancing the skills of the population, to providing basic services, then not only will people and businesses pay them, but societies will flourish, as is the case of South Korea today. While good governance is obviously critical at the national level, the issue does highlight one significant institutional failure in the globalized economy of today. There is no international mechanism to define ethical parameters or otherwise regulate the behavior of multinational corporations at the global level. Since the largest companies and financial institutions are larger than most national economies, this is a significant gap as it leaves room for rapacious resource extraction, neglect of the environment, tax avoidance, and exploitation of poor workers, among other vices. The power of business lobbies is hard for even the largest governments to resist, not to mention governments that are weak or ineffective or open to corruption. As a result, the private sector is often excluded from participation in governance mechanisms. Yet business needs a level playing field at the global level for its innovation and competitiveness to work effectively in support of sustainability. It is simplistic just to call for a new development model. Quite aside from the practical problems associated with giving this operational meaning, we have learned by now that there is no secret to ensure sustainable development and that the ingredients of success are many in number. They vary from country to country in their relative importance. depending on their stage of development, and evolve over time. Furthermore, the issue has nothing to do with capitalism, a useless and stale concept in terms of its ability to help us understand better how to tackle world poverty or other global problems. A more promising approach to this subject is to frame the discussion of world poverty, how to reduce it and how to do so respecting the environment and planetary resource limits, in terms of the identification of critical factors needed to generate processes of growth for the poor within a sustainable framework, without entering into a largely fruitless debate about the role of capitalism in helping or not helping us to get there. Alongside this, we do need to discuss the overconsumption of the wealthy, which has not left sufficient resources for the poor, and a global economic system that often transfers wealth from the poorest countries to the industrialized world, maintaining systemic poverty. The ideological debate may have been relevant and perhaps even interesting 30 years ago, but the world has moved on, and governments are increasingly judged by voters, not for the extent of their ideological purity, but rather for the real results of their policies, by the extent to which these serve the broader interests of society in those areas that enhance the quality of life for the community. In the longer term, we do need research into new economic policies that are more altruistic and cooperative, create meaningful employment, and reduce poverty. Such principles implied a profound transformation, not so much in the mechanisms of the economy, but in the values that underlie it, and in the institutions, both private and public, through which it operates. At the moment, a greater focus at the community level, with new economic models and experiments for development and poverty elimination, driven from the bottom up, may be more fruitful than the present top-down, aid-given approach to development.